If you travel to certain parts of the world today, and you try to speak to people about Jesus, to tell them who Jesus is, you may get arrested. Certainly North Korea, China, parts of the Middle East might get you more than arrested. The religion is either officially outlawed or viewed as false. To speak about Jesus Christ is subversive. The good news that is found in the Gospels, it undermines and it threatens the authority of certain regimes in the world. I would suggest to you that ours is one of them. And that's true today. And it was also true when Jesus was traveling with his disciples. At first glance, the opening verse in our gospel lesson from Matthew this morning appears to be a completely throwaway verse. All it does is provide you with the geographic location of where Jesus and the disciples were on that given day. It is the type of information that we see in countless other passages in the Gospels. However, this piece of information is vital to understanding and putting into perspective exactly what is going on in our reading this morning. Jesus and the disciples are at Caesarea Philippi, a Roman city. They are north and west from where Jesus has been doing most of his ministry, probably about 2 days' travel. And it's significant for a couple of reasons. First, Jesus and the disciples are away from prying eyes and ears. They can have their conversation without being overheard by Jewish authorities or risking someone getting back to Herod. But the second reason why this is important is because they are at a Roman city, which is owned and run and was created by the imperial occupying army. It is named after a Roman emperor, who, in accordance with the cult of the empire, is considered a god by the citizens of the empire. A dead Roman emperor is considered a god. They had veneration for that. And so the conversation that Jesus has with his disciples that day is held in the shadows of the power of that Roman empire. Being overheard there could result in their deaths based on the conversation that they had. Jesus asks the disciples, "Who do the people say that I am?" Note, he doesn't start with who the disciples think he is. He starts with the people. Confirm the rumors and the hushed conversations. Now, the answers that are given, I think we should take note of. The disciples reply that you are John the Baptist, that crazy prophet who was living out in the wilderness. And others say that you are Elijah who did not die, but was rather taken up to heaven by God in a whirlwind. In other words, people were not saying that Jesus was this great guy who loved children, who was gentle, and who was meek. People were saying that Jesus was a force to contend with, a force of nature. That Jesus was a dead prophet come back to set the people straight. That Jesus was a prophet declaring the righteousness of God. I mean, folks, Jesus was the voice in the back of our head that we don't want to hear. Jesus is the guy who is telling us that everything we think we're doing right, well, maybe not so much. Maybe we could do better. And if we're honest with one another, most of us don't like the person who corrects our behavior. They annoy us because we know they're right. And what is worse, what they are telling us will often force us to make changes in our life that we might find uncomfortable or unpleasant. And it is only then that Jesus asks the disciples who they think he is, which sets the stage for Peter's famous confession. And Peter replies, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." And what Peter acknowledges and confesses in our reading from today is what the Canaanite woman realized in our lesson from last week. And with those words, Jesus renames Peter and says to him that upon this rock I will build my church. And this is where I think things start to get a little bit tough and challenging for us. Because Jesus says, I will build my church. Not you will build my church. Not you will build your church. I will build my church. Not yours or mine, Jesus's. Jesus is going to do the building. And I think that that has an implication for us about how we think about church, about how we think about our community of faith. And the question we need to decide upon this is, what is Jesus building his church from? In our lesson, we have two options, I think. Is it Peter himself? Or is it the testimony that Peter gives? And this is a question that has divided this church, or the church universal, I should say. And it, at its heart, deals with apostolic succession. The Roman Catholic Church interprets this passage as the rock being Peter. Peter the man. Which every pope from today, from Pope Francis all the way down, can see a clear line of apostolic succession all the way back to Peter. It's where the Pope's authority is derived from. And others say, no, it's his testimony that matters. For myself, good Protestant that I am, I'm in the second camp. I think that it is Peter's confession that is important here. The rock is not Peter. It is Peter's testimony. In other words, it is not you or me, but it is rather what we confess. It is what we believe about God. I mean, look at Peter. Peter's got the worst track record going. This is the guy who denies Christ 3 times just before he is killed. So it's not about individual strengths or weaknesses. Instead, it is about our understanding and our acknowledging that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, our Savior, the Messiah. And that testimony is what Jesus is going to build his church on. Friends, Peter's confession and Jesus' reception of that confession, it forces us to take our own egos out of any question or concern about the church. Because it's not about us. It's about God. Whether we like it or not, friends, the church is not a voluntary association of like-minded people. Nor is it a means to an end. Yes, those things happen. But that's not what the church is about. The church is an article of faith. Jesus will build his church. Jesus does not say, build your church. He says, I will build my church. And I think we've all gotten this wrong historically. I mean, historically, the church has tried so hard to affirm its authority through external means. Look back through the history of the church. Consider the Reformation. All the councils, all the ecclesiastical councils, going all the way back to when the Emperor Constantine of that same Roman Empire, called the first ecclesial council. From that time forward, we have worked hard to codify and control what the church is and what it looks like. And as Presbyterians, we are very good at this because we like things neat and orderly. We have our book of forms. Nothing wrong with it. However, I would suggest to you that when we look at the church today, that we are moving away from a time where things are always so neat and orderly and buttoned down. And perhaps we are moving into a time that is a lot less comfortable than what we've been used to. Douglas John Hall is a Canadian theologian, and he writes a great deal about the end of Christendom. Christendom started at that first ecclesial council that the Emperor Constantine called, and it ended sometime in the 50s or the 60s. And in his book, The End of Christendom and the Future of Christianity, Paul writes, "The opportunity that comes to serious Christians at the very point where Christianity seems to be in decline is an opportunity that has seldom presented itself in Christian history. Namely, the opportunity actually to become salt and yeast and light that the Newer Testament speaks of as the character of Christ's disciple community. To grasp this opportunity, however, we must relinquish our centuries-old ambition to be the official religion, the dominant religion, the dominant culture. We must disengage ourselves from our society if we are to re-engage our society at the level of truth, justice, and love." Now, I know that that's a mouthful. If you would like to read more about that in the book I mentioned, it is 66 pages and it's broken into four sections. You can read it easily over four nights. And it's rather easy to digest as you move through it. Friends, the foundation of the church is not found in our doctrine. It is not found in people. It's not found in me. It's not found in you. It's not found in John the Baptist. It's not found in Luther or Calvin. And it's not found in Peter. Church is not founded on people. The church is founded on the answer to a question that Jesus asks. Who do you say that I am? That is the rock upon which the church is built. That Jesus Christ is the Son of God. That is the source of any and all Christian authority. And this passage, therefore, I think it makes a demand of us that we move past our political affiliations, our denominational associations, our ethnic backgrounds, and our theological perspectives. It demands that because it speaks to a truth that we too often overlook or simply take for granted, that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, and it is that testimony that matters, that testimony that the church is built on. Anything we do as a church is dependent on us first recognizing that affirmation that is made by Peter. And that affirmation forces us to look at what Jesus does for us, at what God does for us, to recognize that weakness is praised, to realize that we are called to be a community of faith together. A community that testifies to the life-giving power that we realize in Jesus Christ. And I think it makes us ask a further question. To ask, what has God been doing in our lives? What has God been doing in our lives? If we affirm Peter's testimony, and then if we ask that question, what has God been doing in our own lives? And we must ask ourselves, how do we, as people of faith, as followers of Christ, who live in one of the most powerful countries in the world, in the shadow of the most powerful country of the world, how does Peter's confession that day change our lives? If we echo Peter's confession, if we testify that Jesus is the Messiah, the Son of the living God, what does that really mean for us? What does it mean in the building up of Christ's church, in the living of our lives? What happens when we really do that? What is asked of us when we make that confession? And friends, where that confession is said, in the shadow of that Roman city, it matters, because it's countercultural. It could have got the disciples and Jesus killed, and as we know, testifying to being a Christian today can still get you killed. Think to yourself, when was the last time you asked yourself or a friend what God was doing in your life? When's the last time you asked your spouse or your kids that? When's the last time you asked the person in the pew in front of you or behind you that? When was the last time that you shared with a friend or a work colleague that Jesus Christ was the Son of God, the Messiah? You don't need to answer. You and I both know the looks we get when we say those words, when we ask that question. We know what would be said behind our backs, because the world that we live in today is still not ready to hear this message. It does not want to hear the message that is in this book. It is afraid of the message that we find in this book, because it challenges to the very core the lives that we live. And yet, we confess Christ as Lord. And we are called to be a part of His church, to carry out His mission in a world that just wants us to go away. And so we must find new ways to do old things, to carry out the mission of truth, justice, and love that God, through Jesus Christ, calls us on. Amen.